From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Nicky Scarfo ruled the Philadelphia mob for most of the 1980s. It was one of the most violent reigns in organized crime history, until Scarfo became the first mob boss convicted of murder. On today's Fresh Air, we meet Frank Friel, one of the investigators who helped break the Philadelphia mob. Also, a talk with the oddball accordionist who turned Beat It to Eat It and La Bamba into Lasagna, Weird Al Yankovic. Rock critic Ken Tucker tries to find a singer-songwriter with a new record worth listening to. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Arachnophobia, starring Jeff Daniels, John Goodman, and lots of spiders. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. An explosion that shattered windows for blocks around a North Cincinnati chemical plant today has claimed two lives. Fire officials say at least one other person is missing and 45 have been injured. The blast ripped through the BASF plant, a four-story building that covers almost a full city block. Officials say it took 2.5 hours to contain the blaze, enough so that they could enter the building. Baseball's all-time hit leader has been given a 5-month federal prison term after pleading guilty to cheating on his taxes. Lorna Jordan of member station WVXU reports.
A federal judge in Cincinnati also sentenced the former Cincinnati Reds manager to 3 months in a halfway house, 1,000 hours of community service with inner-city youngsters, and a $50,000 fine. During the court proceedings, Rose apologized and said he's lost his dignity, his self-respect, and nearly lost a lot of good friends. Now Rose's thoughts may turn to the Hall of Fame. Cincinnati Enquirer columnist Tim Sullivan is sticking by the hit king.
Barring any further evidence to the contrary, anything that would suggest that he bet against the Reds or fixed the game, I would still vote for him.
However, many sports writers say they will not vote for Rose to enter the Hall in Cooperstown. For National Public Radio, I'm Lorna Jordan in Cincinnati.
The government of Angola, in a policy reversal, says it will allow shipments of humanitarian aid into territory held by the rebel group UNITA. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
The Angolan ambassador to the United Nations, Manuel Pedro Pacavira, says his government is willing to work with the U.S. State Department and the International Red Cross to deliver food aid to any area of Angola. The Angolan government had previously objected to U.S. food aid deliveries. It suspected that weapons hidden among the food might be delivered to the U.S.-backed forces of Jonas Savimbi. U.S. officials ridiculed that suspicion. Now U.S. officials say they are encouraged by the Angolan government's change of heart. However, details of the food aid delivery still must be worked out. U.S. officials say some 782,000 people face starvation in southern Angola. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Refugees fleeing the civil war in Liberia report that rebels appear to have launched a major offensive against the capital city, Monrovia. Witnesses say the rebels are fighting around a railroad terminal about 3 miles from the center of the city. Prices on Wall Street came to a mixed close today, recovering from a broad early decline that analysts say was caused by disappointing second quarter earnings reports, notably from technology companies. The day's most conspicuous losers were concentrated among technology issues. A wave of late buying pushed the Dow Jones Industrial Average to a gain of 12 points to close at 2,993.8. Declines led advances 4-3 in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1980s was a decade of bloody mob wars in Philadelphia. It was also the decade when the mob was broken. My guest Frank Friel played a key role in convicting mob boss Nicky Scarfo of murder and putting many of his henchmen away, too. Friel is a former Philadelphia police detective who became the chief investigator and co-director of an organized crime task force jointly run by the Philadelphia Police and the FBI. The 80s started with the murder of Philadelphia mob boss Angelo Bruno, who was nicknamed the Gentle Don. His successor, Phil Testa, was murdered 1 year later. Then Nicky Scarfo became the Don, ruling over Philadelphia and Atlantic City with its new gambling casinos. Law enforcement authorities believe Scarfo authorized, participated in, or personally committed at least 26 murders during his career as a criminal. He was convicted of one of those murders in 1989. By the end of the decade, there were 60 other convictions in his organization. Friel has written a new book called Breaking the Mob. I asked him about the significance of dismantling the Philadelphia mob.
Well, there was a number of significant issues that we dealt with Nicky Scarfo and the Philadelphia mob. Number one, it was the first time in the history of La Cosa Nostra that narcotics had played such a significant role. The Honored Society, or the LCN, La Cosa Nostra, never involves itself with narcotics. What the convictions in the RICO case clearly established that the Philadelphia LCN was replete with their involvement in narcotics, starting with Nicky Scarfo himself and going right down to the street-level distributors. Another significant role of the convictions of the Philadelphia mob was the enormity of the violence that had been perpetuated on the streets of Philadelphia, going back to the assassination of Angelo Bruno in March of 1980. When you consider the relative numbers of the mob, knowing now through Breaking the Mob that the membership never exceeded about 70 made members, and some 35 made members and associates were slaughtered in the streets, it was a significant turmoil. The enormity of the bloodshed would date back to Chicago in the Roaring Twenties. Those are very key, significant areas. And, of course, with the conviction of Scarfo himself for first-degree murder, that certainly established a landmark in regard to the ability the law enforcement has to come together to join forces in targeting a significant, violent head of La Cosa Nostra. And that's exactly what had occurred here in Philadelphia.
From your vantage point as a Philadelphia police officer, one of the significant aspects of this case was that the FBI and the Philadelphia police worked together. Why is that so unusual, the FBI and the police cooperating in a case like this?
It would stand to reason, and I guess it calls upon your concern for common sense that law enforcement works together to target, in the interest of society, a common element, which is the criminal. Unfortunately, what occurs frequently is each individual law enforcement agency becomes so caught up with their primary responsibilities that the obvious sometimes is overlooked. In 1982, the FBI took it upon themselves, because of their frustration with solving organized crime murders and the Philadelphia Police Department's frustration with the lack of the ability to solve these murders. The special agent charge, John Hogan, and the head of the organized crime component in the FBI, Dennis O'Callaghan, visited Commissioner Solomon in the Philadelphia Police Department and broached the concept of sharing information.
Did this bring up differences in how the FBI and the police go about doing the job of collecting information?
Oh, I think so, yeah.
What were some of those differences?
Some of the differences were that the Philadelphia Homicide Division works with absolutely no funds in the sense of paying for informants' information. We have no funds as far as establishing safe houses, provide vehicles, that type of fund, or limited funds. The Organized Crime Squad, through the FBI, had funds that were sufficient to induce people to come forward to give us essential information that led to the clearing of many of these homicides.
The FBI had more money than the Philadelphia police ever did for buying information. What does information go for?
Well, it depends on the nature of the crime. I've seen $25,000 paid out for information which led to arrest of two very high-profile murderers for a single bit of information. And there's a graduated scale depending upon the value of that information to law enforcement.
Do you pay in check or in cash?
In cash. People that we deal with rarely accept a check.
My guest is Frank Friel, and from 1982 to 88, he was the chief investigator and co-director of the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force in Philadelphia. And he's written a new book called Breaking the Mob about the cases that broke the Philadelphia mob. There were mob wars going on at the time that you were investigating the Philadelphia mob. A lot of violence, a lot of murders within the mob. Why was it such a tumultuous, violent period for the mob in Philadelphia?
I think it was a characteristic of the transition between a relatively docile reign of Angelo Bruno, who reigned between 1959 and his assassination in 1980. Not that homicides were not committed, but they were not committed with the frequency or the level of violence, or the type of homicide was not committed, so it came to the attention of law enforcement and to the public in general. They were few and far between, meaning homicides were few and far between. After Angelo Bruno, then Phil Testa succeeded Angelo Bruno. He was assassinated within a year, for almost at a corresponding date on March the 15th of 1981. With Testa's death, then Nicodemo Scarfo was elevated to the position of Don of La Cosa Nostra, the Philadelphia South Jersey family. And a level of violence was increased that Philadelphia had never experienced, probably no major city in the country had ever experienced, going back to the wild and rip-roaring days of Prohibition in the 1920s. Everybody came under his scrutiny, meaning everybody in the mob or the associates who were not paying either tribute, they were not being extorted. Even petty rivalries that existed prior to the time that Scarfo was a mob. At this point in his life, he decided to be very, very vindictive, and it cost these people who had offended him literally generations ago, their lives.
Was this a good time for you to try to break the mob, a time when there was a lot of violence within the mob?
It turned out, coincidentally enough, to be very fortuitous for law enforcement. When you could focus on something as catastrophic as a number of human lives that were being lost, not only murdered, but left on the streets for the citizens in general to view, then it was a clear mandate that law enforcement better do something about it. It also created a lasting impression on the mob members themselves that the slightest wrong, whether real or imagined, committed in the presence of Scarfo may cost them their lives.
In Philadelphia, RICO was used to break the mob, the Racketeer-Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. How did that help you make the case? What did RICO give you that you wouldn't have had before in breaking the Philadelphia mob?
One of the benefits for law enforcement for the RICO concept is that you don't have to prove the elements of a single crime. So it afforded law enforcement to bring in the totality of the crimes that this La Cosa Nostra family was using to the detriment of society. And of course, we were able to bring in some 9 murders, the attempted murders, the extortions, the loan sharking, the gambling, the narcotics into one case. The overwhelming nature of this evidence, the admissible evidence, was sufficient in this case to produce beyond a reasonable doubt the guilt for the jury to accept and move forward with their guilty verdicts. We had tried prior to the RICO to establish beyond a reasonable doubt Scarfo and his henchmen's involvement in the Salvatore Testa Commonwealth case of murder. We were not successful in doing that because we were only permitted to introduce, of course, those elements that were on trial, and that was the Testa case. With the RICO, we were permitted to bring in all the elements, the organization, and that's what this is. This is a corrupt organization. La Cosa Nostra, and this in Philadelphia's case, was a very violent organization.
As the co-director of the Organized Crime Task Force, one of the things that you did was to turn mobsters. One of the people who you tried to turn into an informant, and I think finally succeeded in doing, was Mario Riccobini, whose half-brother was Harry the Hunchback.
Yes.
Riccobini. And to try to convince him to give you information, you brought in his wife and his daughter.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And what happened?
Well, I thought that I was very persuasive as far as ultimately what the penalty for Mario would be. We already had arrested Mario on first-degree murder. We had a warrant, a valid warrant. We had information that he participated in a conspiracy that led to the assassination of the consigliere, which is the counselor of the Philadelphia mob, a fellow by the name of Frank Monti. We had admissible evidence indicating that we could move forward with this trial. I approached him. He agreed that probably if a deal could be worked out, meaning that he would testify truthfully in exchange for consideration of sentence. But it was still a tremendous thing for him to overcome because there is an oath of office that these gentlemen take or the participants take, and it's a tremendous difficult time for them to get over, to cooperate. All their lives have been involved on the opposite side of the law. They're criminals. And to broach the concept of now cooperating with the enemy, meaning law enforcement, is very difficult. One of the things that I thought would make it easier for him if his family came in to say, you have to do this for us. So I brought in his wife and I brought in his daughter and gave a very persuasive and I believed at the time eloquent speech in the interest of this family. We could keep this family together in time, although Mario would have to go to jail for his crimes, but somewhere in the future you could see the light at the end of the tunnel. I was absolutely devastated to learn that his daughter was not so accepting in the eloquence of my speech and the prospect of having the family together, but she much preferred to enjoy the status of being a mobster's daughter in South Philadelphia, which is the area that the mob in Philadelphia primarily controls. And her principal concern was not being able to go back to the local beauty shop, not being able to go back to the local pizza pie place where she was regarded as almost a princess, you know, to use the phrase mafia princess. She was had that status. She had the recognition. She had the name. She was somebody's daughter. If that person turned out to be an informant, then she wouldn't enjoy that. And her principal concerns was for herself and not for the welfare of her father.
So what did you do? Get the family out of there?
My jaw dropped down to my kneecaps, and I had to separate the family from this ongoing dialogue, and I brought this young woman out and tried to be, again, very convincing in the interest and welfare of her father. Father certainly had provided a very nice lifestyle for her up to that point. And I explained to her as best I could that the ultimate penalty here, and this is a capital offense, we're talking about first-degree murder, was her father would be electrocuted, and that she should give due thought to that and balance the two concerns that she have, her status at the pizza pie parlor and her father's life. She was intractable. She said he was born into this. This is what he meant to be served. He knew the risk getting into it, and he should do what he has to do, keep his mouth shut and go to prison.
So what was the outcome?
Well, the outcome was I thanked the family for coming in. I thanked them for their participation. I sat down with Mario again, and I explained what his options were. Mario was not a stupid man. He's very intelligent, as a matter of fact, and he opted to do the thing that would guarantee that he would be back with his family sometime in life. He guaranteed that he would testify truthfully for law enforcement, and he eventually did two significant murder trials here in Philadelphia.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Frank Friel, and from 1982 to 88, he was the chief investigator and co-director of the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force in Philadelphia. And he's written a book about their case against the Philadelphia mob. It's called Breaking the Mob. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Frank Friel is my guest, and his new book is called Breaking the Mob. One of the things that you would do while you were heading up the organized crime task force was drop in on the organized crime bars.
Mm-hmm.
What would you do when you get there? Order a drink? Talk to people?
You would go around. You would see who was there. You would recognize the relationships. It's a very formalized structure in who talks to who. It would help you identify who the movers and shakers were. And after that was firmly committed in your mind, and yes, that's exactly what myself and other members of the task force would do. We'd go up and strike up informal conversation. They knew who we were, obviously. Of course, we knew who we were. They were. And it was through that you could start to break down some of the resistance that prevents you from gaining any insights into their personality, finding where the vulnerabilities were. And that was exactly the purpose of this, see who was out at what hour, what place they frequented, who was with who had loyalties to somebody else over here, if you could, certain conversations that would lead you to believe that suspicion existed between these people who were there and other members of the bar. Guys who would remain together, you knew that you're not going to separate them. Guys who were distant from each other, maybe drinking at the same bar but at different ends of the bar, you knew you could probably drive a wedge between. And the whole purpose of that was to gather intelligence, plant seeds, talk on an informal basis. These guys get to know you in a less threatening manner.
Who would possibly talk with you in a mobster bar with everybody else watching? Everybody knows you're a cop.
A lot of times people, they become more loud and more garrulous. They become, they want everybody to know, since everybody knows who you are, that they're not talking about who's committing what crime. But one of the characteristics that I have found with certainly the Philadelphia LCN is there's many, many members who are absolutely charming people. I don't want to create a wrong impression. I mean, they are murderers, and we've established that beyond anybody's doubt. But if they were not murderers, as far as their personalities were concerned, frequently they were very charming people and would give the impression that they wanted to help you. But it would be clear and it would be loud, so everybody with an earshot would know clearly what they're talking about. But what the benefit for law enforcement is that you get to be known, and you get to know the personality, and you can walk in on somebody. And somebody who's seen talking with you is not immediately under suspicion, because people have seen and heard those conversations before.
So people didn't walk out and leave when
they
you walked in?
They didn't walk out and leave, no. Not all the time. This was their turf, and that was one of the things that you wanted to clearly establish. You're coming into there, you're with hat in hand, you're looking to establish a relationship. And not only the mob members themselves, but hangers-on, which were very, very informative as far as law enforcement is concerned.
How many drinks could you have and still feel like you were being productive at the bar?
I'm a nurser. You know, you get a bottle of beer and you walk around and you sit, and you, as long as you have that bottle in your beer in your hand, then you're fine.
It's been said about the Philadelphia mob that never before had so many members of the same organization come forward to testify against a former associate, Nicky Scarfo, who was the head of the mob. Why did he command so little loyalty from the men? I mean, let's face organized crime, there's the oath of silence, and here you have so many people coming forward and turning or testifying.
Because he was treacherous, and he was recognized as treacherous. There is no honor among this group, among the La Cosa Nostra families. Once again, it's predicated on somebody's willingness to commit murder, and frequently of their closest friends, and how you do that is you stab them in the back. But the level of violence that Scarfo introduced to the Philadelphia family was unequaled in La Cosa Nostra history. Consequently, it made it not easy, but maybe relatively easy compared to other organized crime families, because his own members knew they could not trust this man. The own members knew that it was only a matter of time before some insignificant slight may result on a contract on their lives. And at first, it was tremendously difficult to gain credibility with the mobsters itself, but with each successful prosecution that we had, each time we treated an informant fairly, someone who would come forward and testify, we sent a message to the mob that they didn't have to be murdered, that they did have some place to go. And this exactly was the principle that we were operating under.
What's left of the Philadelphia mob, and who has filled the vacuum?
The Philadelphia mob will remain. As far as the leader of the mob, it's probably a gray area now. Scarfo will continue to lead a mob until he's considered so vulnerable by the existing members that they'll no longer follow any of his lead. And it's not an unusual event that a mob boss can continue to rule the mob from prison. But basically, what law enforcement in Philadelphia has done was destroy the infrastructure of the mob, destroy the people who were valued and experienced employees of La Cosa Nostra at each and every level, starting from the boss to many, many of the soldiers. And the soldiers are the people that the boss depends upon to actually do the job. He remains insulated. So uncharacteristically of law enforcement success here in Philadelphia, we've destroyed their ability to maintain an ongoing organization. But we would be very naive indeed to believe that we destroyed La Cosa Nostra here, because this is an organization that has literally survived for some 2,000 years. And there are those that have remained untouched either by homicides or the success of law enforcement who wait in the wings to come forward to determine how deeply they'll become involved and who will be the next leader.
Frank Friel is my guest, and from 1982 to 1988, he was the chief investigator and co-director of the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force in Philadelphia. He's written a new book called Breaking the Mob. There's another part of your story that you tell in your new book, and that's a story of you actually trying to get somebody off murder charges.
That's correct.
Who was the person, and why were you trying to get him off?
We had a double murder that occurred in Philadelphia in one of the downtown restaurants called Melita's Restaurant in 1981. It was just the beginning of the slaughter of mob figures on the street, where two masked gunmen entered this restaurant and shot a number of people at the table. They shot two people. Both people died. Through the course of the investigation, a fellow by the name of Neil Ferber, who had a long history of criminal involvement, but minor crimes, was arrested, tried, and convicted. His sentence was two death penalties, one for each one of the murders. He had lost his appeal, and he was waiting on death row for the execution of his sentence. Through my involvement with other organized crime homicides, as the task force developed credibility in mob circles, I began to get feedback amongst the mob who knew the actual circumstances of this crime. These people were telling me, this is a mafia murder, and the guy that you guys have on death row is not the guy. So that struck up my awareness for the potential that we had an innocent man on death row.
So what did you do to try to get him off, and did you succeed?
I investigated the elements of the crime, who most likely would have been the participant as opposed to this fella. And yes, I was successful after a long, torturous period of getting this guy out And eventually the authorities recognized, and we recognize today, that he was wrongfully convicted. It was a long, torturous process, and frequently the system is not geared up to recognize its mistakes because it's so difficult to get someone convicted. The standards of admissibility of evidence are very, very high for that reason, because we don't want to convict innocent people.
But why did you persist?
I persisted because it became an obsession with me. Once I became the recipient of the information from my mob informants, who now had a lot of credibility with me and looked to me to do something about it, because they become very moral. Once they flip, then they give you all the information that they have and fell on my shoulders to move this case forward, to clearly establish that the system had failed and it was up to the system to rectify the error. And ultimately, that's exactly what happened. The system broke down because this fellow was wrongfully convicted. But it was the system itself that got through the Philadelphia Police Department that got this guy off of death row, and he walked out a free man.
What do you think other cities with organized crime problems on their hands could learn from what happened in Philadelphia?
I think the basic principle of the lesson to be learned was to recognize that there exists a law enforcement community, and it's a valuable community. When you strike out on your own, then you don't have the resources that are available, even the large departments like Philadelphia, New York, Chicago, because we are so self-sufficient. We believe that we are the end-all and the be-all, and a lot of times we're not open to suggestions from other law enforcement agencies. When you open your mind, when you go with your hat in hand to another law enforcement agency like the FBI, which of course is a nationally professional organization, and say we need help and we're willing to accept it.
You retired from the Philadelphia police force. Do you ever run into any of the mobsters and informants that you dealt with over the years in Philadelphia?
I get a call. I have an open line for these fellows that I've convicted, and my secretary marvels frequently of my remaining in contact with these people. But again, it's a matter of credibility. We have steered them through a very, very treacherous period of time in a murky waters of what ultimately will be the remainder of their lives. I'm not in a position now where I'm willing to cut them off. When they call up, it's a lot of time just to chat. And it makes them feel good to know that somebody within the system still remains in touch with them, even though their term is still largely in front of them. It gives them a basic semblance of belief in the system of individuals, that policemen are not robocops, that they're not machines, that they are human beings capable of feeling, having empathy and sympathy for their plight in life.
So what are they called to talk about?
Well, they talk about whether or not they think it's premature that they should appeal to the governor of the state to reduce their sentence. They talk about contemporary issues in the news. They're very well read because they have a lot of time on their hands. And what ifs? What ifs? It's always what if. What if I didn't testify? Could I be the mob boss today? You know, what if I wasn't going to get killed? What if I didn't do this? What if I didn't do that?
And you reassure them?
I reassure them, sure. I bring them back to reality. It was a very violent time. The potential for that violence to continue was there as long as Scarfo was in the head position there. And it remains regardless of who may assume the leadership role, depending upon the individual characteristics of that person, violence could return.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
Frank Friel was the chief investigator for the Philadelphia Police FBI Organized Crime Task Force. His new book is Breaking the Mob. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, John Storm Roberts. He started writing about, recording, and distributing world music years before anyone was even calling it world music. This is from his first album of African dance music. Do you really boon the best? In time, yeah, bravo, yeah. In the misado, I run in the name, yeah, yeah, and you know. Hey, yeah, 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 yeah.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer, providing the Fresh Air staff the power to be their best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we talk with Weird Al Yankovic. His rock parodies take the sexual appetite out of lyrics and replace it with just plain appetite. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about new albums by singer-songwriters David Bearwald, John Hyatt, and Steve Earle. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews a new movie that gives walk-on parts to zillions of out-of-work spiders. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Applesauce. They never have to buy toothpicks or dental floss. Hey! Stand up! Toothless people! The breath is lethal.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. South Korea has just announced that it will open its border with North Korea next month to allow free travel between residents from both sides. President No Tae-woo said the South will open the southern sector of Panmunjom, a truce border village, around August 15th, on the 45th anniversary of Korea's liberation from Japanese rule. North Korea last month made a similar offer. President Bush and two former GOP presidents joined former President Nixon in California today for the dedication of the Nixon Presidential Library. Presidents Bush, Reagan, and Ford praised the only man ever to resign the presidency, calling him a patriot who furthered the cause of peace. Nick Roman of station KLON reports.
The rare gathering of four presidents drew more than 25,000 people to Nixon's hometown of Yorba Linda, a crowd that cheered Nixon and his wife Pat throughout the dedication. During remarks that praised Nixon's foreign policy skills, President Bush noted the library does include a section on Watergate. It was the only mention made of the political crisis that forced Nixon's 1974 resignation. Nixon's own brief comments focused on the struggle for world peace. He invited visitors to his library to use the history depicted inside as a guide.
I hope you will remember that while the past is interesting, it is important only insofar as it points the way to a better future.
The library is located next to the small wooden house in which Nixon was born in 1913. For National Public Radio, I'm Nick Roman in Yorba Linda, California.
In Rangoon, Burma, truckloads of armed troops patrolled as a group of students demanded that the military government release a leading pro-democracy figure. Mary Kay Magstead reports that four decades ago, a national pro-democracy uprising was crushed by military officers and hundreds of people were killed.
Today is Martyrs' Day in Burma, the day Burma's equivalent of George Washington was assassinated 43 years ago. Pro-democracy supporters in Rangoon had planned to commemorate the day with a big procession. But the presence of armed troops was apparently enough to make people change their plans. 2 years ago, troops killed thousands of such demonstrators during Burma's huge pro-democracy uprising. The pro-democracy movement has now been officially elected Burma's government, but the junta has not yet agreed to even talk about a transfer of power. Pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi, Aung San's daughter, remains under house arrest. Her one-year term of confinement is up today, but the junta has given no sign that it will release her. Her party has opted not to rock the boat in hopes of avoiding more bloodshed. But some pro-democracy activists are clearly growing restless. For National Public Radio, I'm Mary Kay Magstead in Bangkok.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 12 points to close at 2,900. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Coming up, rock parodies from Weird Al Yankovic. But first, songs by three veteran singer-songwriters. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of three new albums by John Hyatt, Steve Earle, and David Bearwald.
The more I learn, I find how little I really know. And I'm standing here before you, don't know nothing at all. Except there is no singing grace, no miracle cures, and no resting place. But look in the mirror, see straight.
One of this season's most acclaimed albums has been David Bearwald's Bedtime Stories. 4 years ago, Bearwald was half of David and David, a Los Angeles duo that put out one album called Boomtown that was one of the most acclaimed albums of its season. Both Boomtown and Bedtime Stories are filled with Bearwald's lugubrious voice and melancholy point of view. Like a lot of good singer-songwriters, he writes best about the worst things: bad romances, depression, despair.
Crime in the streets. It's almost more than I can bear. It happened again last week. But nobody seems.
I find it hard to climb on the bandwagon for Bearwald's Bedtime Stories. For one thing, there's that voice of his, which I find dolorous whenever it's not flatter than a CD. I don't ask for a technically proficient voice, just an expressive one. And in too many of Bearwald's lyrics, the despair strikes me as unearned, as a pose that doesn't have much thought behind it. Searching for a singer-songwriter who might have more to say, I turned with great hope to John Hiatt and his new release, Stolen Moments.
Well, you can sprinkle all your teardrops across the evening sky, but you cannot hide that twinkle of starlight in your eye. Well, I left my map way back there, baby. I don't know where we are, but I'm gonna pull my pony up and hitch my wagon to your star. You got a real fine love. You got a real fine love. One I am unworthy of. Yes, you got a real fine love, baby.
John Hiatt is another one of those cult favorites with a raspy voice and a hard-boiled attitude. That is, until a couple of years ago. Nowadays, Hiatt is downright chipper, and it's fun to hear him try his hardest to crack the top 40 with music that's rough yet commercial, raggedly sung but beautifully played.
She has a wind as a witness. She has feelings that fly by night. She believes in forgiveness, but it's not love if it holds too tight.
Still, John Hiatt's pleasures on Stolen Moments are thin ones. I went on to a third singer-songwriter, Steve Earle, who's just put out a record called The Hard Way. I played the first cut.
See, it used to be I was really free. I didn't need no gasoline to run. Oh, you could say Jack Kerouac, you'd turn your back and I'd be gone. Nowadays I got me two good wheels. I seek refuge in aluminum and steel. Oh, it takes me out there for just a little while, and the years fall away with every mile. I'm back out on that road again. Turn this beast into the wind. Fear those that break and bend.
Oh dear. I like Steve Earle. I like his ragged John Prine-ish voice. But all this melodramatic, I'm an outsider, self-mythologizing seemed like a shameless attempt to court the Springsteen crowd. I listened to the whole first side and thought, here's a guy who must think this is his last chance on a major label, and he's selling out right and left. But then I turned the cassette over, and it was a revelation. Here was where Steve Earle had hidden the good stuff.
Balls and crazy.
The Hard Way is a compromised yet cagey record with sops to the record company on the first side and rough-edged, personal, terrific music on the other side. But those few songs are the best ones I've heard from a singer-songwriter in quite a while.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed new albums by John Hiatt, Steve Earle, and David Bearworld. This is Fresh Air. He took Joan Jett's hit song, I Love Rock and Roll, and turned it into I Love Rocky Road. Madonna's Like a Virgin became Like a Surgeon, and La Bamba came out as Lasagna. Weird Al Yankovic not only does parodies of some of rock's most popular hits, but he also fronts his band playing an accordion. Yankovic has now released 8 albums, won 2 Grammys, and wrote and starred in the film UHF. This week, he's performing at the International Comedy Festival in Montreal. The Showtime cable channel will broadcast live from the festival on Saturday night. Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet spoke with Weird Al Yankovic and asked him how he first started playing the accordion.
Well, my parents made the life-altering decision that I should take accordion lessons. I guess they just wanted me to be real popular in high school. I think one of the reasons they decided that I should take lessons is because of my last name. Frankie Yankovic, although he's no relation, is famous as America's Polka King. He's from Cleveland, and he had his own polka show there. And in fact, I think my parents had a lot of his old 78s out in the garage, and they just figured there should be at least one more accordion-playing Yankovic in the world.
Did you go to accordion school?
Uh-huh, went to accordion school. In fact, I was in the accordion marching band. There is such a thing. It sounds cruel and unusual, but in fact, Christmas time, 108-year-old accordion players would have to march miles down the street and play Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, and it was pretty sick, looking back on it all.
So what songs would you play?
Oh, again, I mean, mostly polkas. I mean, they didn't let us play Inagata da Vida back then. It was mostly polkas and waltzes and things that you'd come to expect from an accordion, you know, Lady of Spain and the Ilk.
Well, I heard that you actually played at weddings and that you were sort of playing professionally.
Nah, I mean, I played at relatives' weddings, so I wasn't in high demand.
Let's watch Al get up and perform.
Little Alfred and his accordion. Fine entertainment.
Your first big hit was Eat It, right?
Uh-huh.
Was that your first big hit, which was a takeoff on Michael Jackson's Beat It. Can you tell us something about writing that song?
It just seemed like it was, you know, a pretty obvious idea, and it just seemed like a natural for me, and I thought of a lot of interesting visual ideas as well, which I, you know, then I wrote the video around that. So it was just, most of my songwriting revolves around me coming up with a concept or a theme and then eventually compile them into a pop song format.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of Eat It. You actually had to get Michael Jackson's permission to record that song.
That's right. I do have to get permission from all the artists that I do parodies of. And Michael was really great. It's really a pleasure to do a parody of somebody who has such a good sense of humor, who's such a good sport about his work.
At the time you did that, you really weren't very well known. That was your first big hit. So what did he want to know when you went to him? Did he want to hear a demo?
Well, basically, as is his right, I mean, he wanted to approve the final lyrics, which we were, you know, more than happy to let him do that. I mean, there's not that much to know once he's got the final lyrics, because we try to stay as true to the original music as possible.
Are musicians coming up to you now and asking you to do parodies of their songs?
Well, offhandedly, I'm nobody's like down on their knees, but one of the greatest moments in my life was several years ago at a party. I ran into Paul McCartney. You know, I'm a big Beatles fan, and I kind of groveled up to him and said hi, and he said, I didn't know if he'd know who I was or not, and he said, oh, Weird Al, when are you going to do one of my songs? So that was just a big moment in my life.
So when are you?
I don't know.
Are there certain elements that a song has to have in order for it to be good material for a parody?
Well, it's pretty subjective. I generally try to look for something that's upbeat and familiar, something obviously that's been at the top of the charts and getting a lot of saturation, radio airplay, and something with a very strong musical or lyrical hook. I mean, it's kind of hard to define exactly, but just something that I can something that has enough words. That's another problem. Some songs are so repetitive that it's not easy to build a joke around the lyrics.
Of course, you did one of those, the George Harrison song. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was one case where everything else was in place, and it was a catchy song, and everybody knew it, and everybody was getting tired of it. The problem being, the song just didn't have enough words to make fun of, and so I used that as the hook. And the title of the parody is, "This Song's Just 6 Words Long."
And that's Weird Al Yankovic doing a takeoff of George Harrison's. What was the real title of that?
Got My Mind Set on You.
That's right.
Actually, George didn't write that. That's a song from the late 50s, I believe.
Oh.
Rudy Clark, I think, is a songwriter.
Did you get his permission?
Yeah. It was a lot easier to get permission from Rudy Clark.
Than George. <yeah. laughs> What are some of the little details that you listen for that really define some of these artists' styles of singing? Like, what are some examples?
Well, Michael Jackson is a really good case. He's got a lot of really interesting idiosyncrasies. He's got all his little hiccups and nah, little weird vocal things that he does that make it pretty identifiable. And James Brown, obviously, with hey and all those kind of things. So I look for those little trademarks.
You got your start in the music business right at the time that writing a song wasn't enough. You also had to come up with a video.
Right, yeah.
And actually, you mentioned before that when you come up with a song, you do come up with a visual concept, too. Is that right?
Not always. In fact, not all songs of mine really lend themselves to video. My record company more than once has wanted to put out a single and make me do a video for it, and I would refuse to do the video just because I felt the song worked better as a song only and that a video just wouldn't add anything to it. There are some cases where a video enhances a song and makes it that much funnier, and those are the ones that I do. If I can add an additional layer of humor through video, that's when I do it.
You've imitated people who give some of the most sexually charged performances in rock, like Madonna and Michael Jackson. How do you see yourself when you're imitating their moves?
Well, you know, when I do like Michael Jackson, his soul and spirit invades my body and forces me to dance against my will. So I become a sexually charged person. Sometimes I can't get rid of that persona for weeks and weeks on end. It's a burden that I have to live with.
You know, I hate to tell you this, but it somehow just doesn't come across in the same way when you do it as Madonna.
Well, you know, Madonna's another case where it was fun to do a Madonna video because I writhe around on the floor a lot just, you know, as a hobby in my spare time. So that was nice to be able to use that in a music video.
In the Fat video, which is a takeoff of Michael Jackson's Bad, you balloon into this hugely obese guy who's wearing the leather suit with the buckles just like Michael Jackson's in his video. What did you have to go through to create that effect?
That was about 3.5 to 4 hours of makeup every morning. I had to get to the set before the sun came up and work with Kevin Yeager, who is famous nowadays for doing all the makeup for Tales from the Crypt for HBO. And I met him a few years ago when I was shooting a series for Steven Spielberg called Amazing Stories, and he made me up into a cabbage man from outer space. And he did such a wonderful job that I asked him to do the fat makeup, and he did a wonderful job.
What was it like to see yourself like that?
Scary. It was really scary. During a lunch break on the set, everybody else would eat on the patio, and I'd have to go to my trailer and eat. And I'd eat in front of this mirror, and I'd have to look at myself in makeup, because obviously I couldn't take it off and put it back on again, because it's such a process. It takes so long to take put on and take off. And it was scary. I was eating extra brownies because I figured it wouldn't make any difference anyway.
You used a cast of pretty fat guys who danced with you in the video. And I was wondering where you found them, because this is such a slender, obsessed society. I doubt that there's much call for fat dancers. I mean, were these actor dancers, and did you audition them?
It's amazing. You can find really anything you want in Los Angeles. You just put an ad out. We put an ad in Variety calling for very fat dancers, to be blunt about it, you know. And we got some. In fact, one of the guys that we wound up using in the video was just delivering a pizza to the casting office, and he was the right shape. And the casting director said, "Can you dance?" And he said, "Well, I guess so." And she said, "You're hired."
You're really best known for doing parodies of other people, but did you have to create a persona for yourself? Like, who is Weird Al?
It's hard to say. It blends, whatever kind of stage persona I have kind of blends into my own persona to the extent that it's kind of difficult to separate. I mean, right now, you're hearing kind of the mellow Al. This is the National Public Radio Al, whereas earlier this morning I was doing a lot of morning show radio interviews, and I was a lot more wacky, and, you know, it's kind of like a volume knob I can kind of turn on and, you know, turn up and turn down, as opposed to a whole different character that I put on. It's like I don't switch from Paul Rubens to Pee Wee Herman. It's more just a matter of degrees.
Okay, great. Well, thanks a lot for talking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Weird Al Yankovic spoke with Fresh Air producer Amy Sallet. He'll perform this Saturday night on the Showtime cable special from the International Comedy Festival in Montreal. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. Tonight we're going to explore the United States' switch in foreign policy on Cambodia a little bit further, trying to get some more points of view and see what sort of sense we can make of it. St. Louis is trying to reabsorb some of the workers about to be laid off by McDonnell Douglas. We will find out about that and ask if this means a recession could be headed our way. We have letters from listeners, and we'll be talking about the Bayside Madonna, a Catholic shrine on the site of the old New York World's Fair. The church doesn't recognize it, but thousands of people come there every year.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Summertime is insect time. There's a new movie that plays on our fear of insect invasions. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of Arachnophobia.
If those Save the Rainforest people had any sense, they'd be out there picketing in front of every theater in America that shows Arachnophobia. After all, the South American rainforest is where the movie begins. And it turns out they have these spiders there. Not the itsy-bitsy kind, the big, ugly, slightly hairy kind. And when these guys bite you, you quiver and sit bolt upright, and your eyeballs do cartwheels, and then your history. Rainforest people, you've got your work cut out for you. And then, have you thought of what would happen if one of those spiders accidentally made its way to the tiny California town of Canaima? What if it actually set up housekeeping, or webkeeping, in the old barn next to the home just purchased by Ross Jennings, played by Jeff Daniels, and his sparkling, shiny wife and two kids? Jennings is the new doctor down from San Francisco, who's eager to set up practice as a general practitioner in Canaima. He doesn't like city crime or grime, and above all, he doesn't like spiders. Not even the harmless little ones his son keeps finding in the new house.
Dad! What? What's wrong?
I'm with a box of spider.
A spider? Okay.
It came at me. It was ugly. Bigger than this.
Okay, all right, calm down. Just, you're in the country now, okay? Come on, let's go find that spider. And let's find your mom to take care of that spider. Honey, we're in the living room. We need you to kill a spider.
Jennings, in short, is an arachnophobe. And I suppose Arachnophobia could be viewed as the story of how he overcomes his childish fear by saving the little town of Canaima when it's overrun by the biggest, nastiest spiders in the world. The movie obviously owes a debt to Hitchcock and the birds, and another to Steven Spielberg and Jaws. Spielberg, in fact, is the movie's producer. And its director, the longtime Spielberg associate Frank Marshall, has captured his master's voice perfectly. From the yummy, saturated colors of the cinematography to the pleasantly generic banter everyone engages in between scares. The scares, by the way, are perfectly calibrated for maximum audience appeal. They don't work on your nerves in that almost sadistic jump from the shadows way that this movie's 1950s predecessors employed. They tickle you more than they devastate you. And in fact, the whole movie is leavened with humor. No more so than in the scenes in which John Goodman appears as the likably slobby exterminator, Delbert McClintock. Here he is meeting Faye Julian Sands, who plays a weirdly intense entomologist.
Delbert McClintock, infestation management. Always nice to meet a colleague.
Now, he believes he came across one of the offending spiders a couple hours ago.
Might you have brought it with you?
Actually, it's probably still in the bottom of my shoe.
Is this my idea of summer fun? Well, sort of. Jeff Daniels is a remarkably genial actor with a gift for exposing the hidden vulnerabilities of even his most characterless characters. Still, he and his family here are of a blandness more suitable to TV movies than big-screen spectaculars. And the film's structure sticks so closely to formula that you can predict practically everything that happens in it from the moment the kingpin spider lands in Canaima. Arachnophobia is mildly funny, mildly creepy, mildly mild. And that may be the way we like our horror movies these days. Spielberg and Marshall have attuned themselves to the gentler mood of the 90s, to a mood that says, hey, the world is jolting enough as it is. So if you're going to scare us, don't try and surprise us in the bargain.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our show is produced this week by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Joyce Lieberman, Thad Kirk, and Ron Barron. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet John Storm Roberts, the founder of a company that was distributing world music long before the current world beat craze. And character actor John Glover tells us about playing the heavy. He's currently starring in Gremlins 2 as the developer and TV mogul. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.